I'm accompanied today by my colleagues, Commissioner Andrew Clapham and Commissioner Barney Afanko, and members of the Secretariat as well. We're delighted at the fact that we were able to speak directly to the South Sudanese people because this broadcast is being carried live. You may be aware of the fact that the Commission on Human Rights was established by the Human Rights Council in March 2016. And at that point, our mandate was to monitor and report on the human rights situation in South Sudan. That mandate was expanded and now includes the collection and preservation of evidence in respect of related crimes, and also clarifying responsibility for alleged gross violations and abuses of human rights and related crimes, with a special focus on sexual and gender-based violence and ethnic violence as well, with the view to ending impunity and to providing accountability. Evidence that the Commission is collecting is being preserved to contribute towards building a factual basis for the hybrid court and will be provided to the prosecutor once that happens. The mandate of the Commission, of course, has been extended now for the third time. We are independent of any structure, including UNMISS and the UN, and we are mandated to engage with the government of South Sudan and regional mechanisms, the African Union, IGAD, as well as the United Nations, the UN mission in South Sudan, and of course many others, so that the idea is that we provide regional support and national support in terms of dealing with questions of accountability for human rights violations and abuses. And of course, we have continued to document violations, to collect evidence and build dossiers on individuals whom we believe bear command responsibility and in fact are preserving these records for the future. Already in 2018, we provided the Human Rights Council with information and advised them that, in fact, we had put 43 individuals on a confidential list and that we had compiled dossiers on them. In March this year, when we reported to the Council, we also identified a further 23 individuals whom we believe bear command responsibility for serious international crimes. Now, this list, of course, is confidential and is provided to the High Commissioner for Human Rights, but it is only to be opened when the hybrid court is established or when any other court requests information, and it will either be the Commission, if we are still in process, or the High Commissioner who will make that decision to release evidence relating to those names. We would like to extend our sincere gratitude to the government of South Sudan for the cooperation and support they have given us since the first time we came here in 2016. This is really a tribute to the government's commitment to the joint resolution that is sponsored in the Human Rights Council. And between the three of us, we have been able to visit most of the hotspots in South Sudan. During this particular visit, with the support of our staff, we have not only been here in Juba, but we've also visited Bentiu, and Commissioner Clapham went to Ye. Both of us returned yesterday. We also plan to visit Addis, Uganda, Gambela, Ethiopia, and Kenya between the 25th of August and the 27th of August. We are going to break up into three teams to be able to do those visits to both refugee camps, but also to meet with South Sudanese refugees who are in those countries, and also NGOs and civil society from those countries. We would like to thank the regional governments of Uganda, Ethiopia, and Kenya for their continued support, including granting us access to meet with South Sudanese refugees during our mission. We'd also like to thank the UNHCR for assisting us with this visit. Of course, in the context of our visits to Juba, Bentiu, and Yei, we met with UN representatives, with international organizations, community members, including religious leaders and civil societies, women's groups, recent returnees from Khartoum, and internally displaced persons. We were encouraged on the ground by the fact that committees have been formed to improve the relationship between civilians and the military, and of course to also support dispute resolution and reconciliation, including the South Sudan Defense Force, the National Security Service, the State Civil Authority, civil society, women's organization, the UN, and humanitarian entities in Yei and in Bentiu. Such mechanisms facilitate communication between armed actors and civilians, and of course should be replicated in other places and locations where conflict continues. Of course, in contrast to our last visit 8 months ago, at that point there was a feeling of cautious optimism about the revitalized peace process. But this time around, interlocutors repeatedly expressed frustration that the key provisions of the revitalized peace agreement, including deadlines, have not been adhered to. And while there has been significant gains in community dialogues, including in Yei and other parts of the country, nevertheless, the conflict at a macro level has actually shifted to localized violence, and you see an increase in cattle raiding. And of course, displacement and boundary disputes have certainly spiked, including in Barghazal. While we note that the overall armed conflict has waned since the signing of the agreement, nevertheless, civilians whom we spoke to still raised numerous concerns that they believe will be barriers to sustainable peace. The concerns include continued impunity, and many women in Bentiu particularly raised the question of ongoing sexual violence and the fact that very little has been done to address the accountability question. Many of them also speak to the delay in the cantonment process and have also raised concerns about the delay in doing that and whether or not this can happen in the rainy season. The localization of conflicts linked to land, resources, cattle raiding, deteriorating living conditions for those internally displaced, and of course, in terms of the securitization of the state, everybody spoke to the shrinking space for civic engagement. And there's a real frustration when we spoke to lawyers about the functioning of the judiciary and the absence of the accountability mechanisms which have been set out in Chapter 5 of the peace agreement, and which includes the hybrid court. Certainly the delay in establishing those is frustrating people. Now, last March, we updated the Human Rights Council on the large degree to which rape and sexual violence continues to be perpetrated in South Sudan. And of course, as long as you're going to have gender-based violence, this really threatens the notion of sustainable peace and, of course, the well-being of women and children countrywide. UNICEF also has estimated that 50% of all girls in South Sudan are married before they reach the age of 18, rendering them vulnerable to violence, to abuse, to exploitation. Some girls, of course, are married off without consent and are struggling to leave unwanted marriages, including in cases where they were married against a bride price at a young age to provide economic relief to their families. We met a large number of women returnees who had come from Khartoum, some of them as young as 20, without any kind of partner, with a number of children, and asking the question, what is going to happen to them? And so these early marriages have often left these young women without any kind of sustainable support. Many of them also spoke to the increased threat of domestic violence, the fact that they were also prey to gender and sexual violence in the communities that they live in, and of course in the extended family homes. They also have limited access to resources. In Bentiu, the women that we spoke to were willing also to share their stories, but asked us quite frankly, what are you going to do for us? What is the government and the UN going to do around ensuring that those who are responsible for these crimes are held accountable? And so there's an increasing frustration, and many of the women speak not to one incident, but repeated incidents over different periods of time in which they have not had one incident of sexual violence, but have suffered multiple rapes, including gang rapes. It's quite shocking when you think about the experiences that women have, and of course the deep frustration around any form of accountability or reparations. Many of these women don't have access to psychosocial support or to medical support. And of course, one of them said to me, when I see this child who has been born of rape, I can't help but feel hatred because I see the face of the man who raped me in the face of this child. Impunity, of course, is at an all-time high. And many survivors say, why should we actually report these cases? We really don't know what's going to happen. And perhaps it's just fruitless to kind of seek justice. A number of others said, we fear retaliation. But we also have to commend, of course, one of the pathways that have been established to address gender-based violence, which includes the establishment of one-stop centers, which are supported by the UNFPA and UNDP. And although safe shelters for women and girls fleeing gender-based violence are missing in the country and remain a necessity, ensuring that medical services are accessible, these begin, I think, to create some kind of safe space for women to kind of recover from what has happened to them. We also note that the transitional justice mechanism set out in Chapter 5 of the peace agreement provide a framework for addressing gross violations and international crimes, including conflict-related sexual violence. Another provision of the agreement requires that 35% of officials within public institutions are women, including in the transitional justice mechanisms. One civil society organization emphasized that besides these quotas, more needs to be done to shape cultural attitudes towards embracing female representation in the echelons of the government, and really a greater inclusion of women in positions of power must materialize. Another key element of the revitalized peace agreement is the cantonment process, designed to reduce violence and assist in the formation of a unified army. While we heard that 37 cantonment sites have been identified countrywide, most sites lack adequate living conditions, including access to water, food, or medical services. We were also told that garrison sites lack qualified instructors, and that certain forces have moved into cantonment sites while others continue to ignore them. As one man described the delayed cantonment process, soldiers on the ground are getting hungry, and there's only a limited amount of time before they will tire of the current stalemate and again resort to taking up arms and looting. Another interlocutor described his disappointment with the process by saying, the intention is there, but there's the lack of will. Excuse me, the aircon's a bit of a problem. We also saw from the IGAD statement that they have urged the president to make available, the $1 million that he had undertaken to set aside for the cantonment process. And in yesterday's statement, this was a key provision. Despite the lack of progress on cantonment, the reduction in hostilities has led to an influx of refugees and internally displaced persons returning over the past year in areas throughout the Western Bahr Ghazal, where 22,000 displaced persons from the WAW protection of civilian site returned to WAW town and to Raja. More than 3,000 internally displaced persons, namely women and children, also returned to Balit County in the Upper Nile. Amongst the POCs, there is a recognition that these sites are often inadequate and need to be closed so encamped residents can return to their areas of origin. But the fact of the matter is that conditions of return are not ready, and many people feel the lack of security. No attempt has been made to deal with the fact that in many cases, the right of return may be an empty right, as their houses and properties remain occupied. In some cases, returns are not voluntary. In Bentiu, for example, I met with several returnees from Sudan who fled north after the conflict had broken out in 2013 and 2016. As they put it, all of them had looked for safety, a better life, and better opportunities. Unfortunately for them, the recent protests in Sudan have meant that they've experienced incredible discrimination. A young boy of 16 said to me that his dark complexion singled him out as South Sudanese, and this resulted in him and the woman who had come through as being targeted as Bashir supporters. Many were forced to undertake really difficult journeys and flee back home to Bentiu, where of course they don't have proper living conditions. Some stress the desire to obtain land and livelihood opportunities. And of course, in a country where almost 7 million people are facing acute food insecurity, one teenage girl told us she just wants land next to her family home where she's able to grow crops and feed herself. In Ye, internally displaced persons narrated to Commissioner Clapham and our team how they are held under a form of siege, making it difficult for them to go out of Ye town to fend for themselves. Women in Ye explained that both government forces and elements affiliated with the National Salvation Front and other armed groups target them if they venture out of Ye town to collect firewood or gather food from abandoned farms, accusing them of providing intelligence to rival groups. Another worrying development is that we heard about is how male returnees are being vetted by government forces to establish their loyalties to one armed group or another. They're also being forcibly encamped in border areas for the duration of the vetting process, which in our view may amount to unlawful administrative detention. The woman who returned from Khartoum also spoke about similar detention. They were kept there for many days before they were allowed to actually move on. The fear of retaliation for expressing dissident opinions has also led to the continued shrinking of civic space. Representatives of civil society in Juba, for example, explained to us how they are still made to seek government approval by high-ranking officials in the security sector prior to conducting workshops. In some cases, government officials sought to determine the size of the workshop, the participants, and also to approve the contents and the facilitators. We also heard of security officers being deployed to follow civil society staff and to monitor their activities. And one religious leader said to us, it's better to be silent and safe than to face repercussions. South Sudanese are also expressing frustration at the functioning of the judiciary for civil and family matters, noting that judges were neither being appointed rapidly nor consistently between courts, which also impacted on the ability to achieve a quorum sitting on important matters. Others complained that the judiciary lacks necessary resources to uphold legal protections, including funding for salaries and modes of transport. One lawyer told us that it can take 1 month to dispose of a simple case, and that in some cases the dockets are up to 10 years old. In a case before the military court in Juba, we heard of an accused who has been languishing in jail for the last 3 years because his accuser has moved and cannot be located. Overall, we were told that the judiciary suffers from a level of disorganization which inhibits the ability of South Sudanese women, men and children to obtain meaningful access to justice, often rendering them unable to have their voices heard. And in fact, the military judges spoke to Barney and said they don't even have money to print their judgments. They go to the marketplace to do so. They don't get salaries or even their rations. And of course, the willingness to want to do the work is there, but the capacity to do it is hampered by all of these difficulties. The current climate, of course, in South Sudan continues to sow fear and anxiety in an already disaffected society. Most individuals do not feel that they are able to speak freely, either on matters related to human rights, nor of the crimes that they have suffered, including survivors of sexual violence. The climate, as we point out, has been exacerbated by the lack of accountability mechanisms. And while the revitalized peace agreement confirmed a commitment to the framework adopted in the 2015 agreement, Chapter 5, to be frank, the delays in all of the implementation dates mean that we're shifting Chapter 5 further and further away. And so it's impossible to speak about meaningful transitional justice as envisaged by the agreement. Moreover, we remain deeply concerned at the lack of progress in establishing these institutions. The hybrid court is the responsibility of the African Union, but the Commission for Truth, Reconciliation and Healing and the Compensation and Reparation Authority, these are intended to be established by the government of South Sudan. Many of the people we spoke to in the country talked about reparations and compensation. This is an important issue where work can already begin to establish what the needs are, what the harm has been that has been suffered, and what the consequences of that are. A reparations framework can already be discussed. And as long, of course, as the voices of victims and survivors are not heard, and these mechanisms are not put in place, it's unlikely that you're ever going to have what we call sustainable peace. You can silence the guns, but sustainable peace needs more. It needs institutional building, and it needs the victims and survivors to be heard. As two men in Juba observed, South Sudan cannot have peace without accountability. We must stress the importance of dealing with the delays regarding the revitalized peace agreement. We note the positive work being carried out by the National Constitutional Amendment Committee, and this is sterling work that they are doing. At the same time, we also heard about initiatives involving young people who are playing a transformative role in their communities by engaging in community mediation and rehabilitating abandoned primary schools. Bentiu is incredibly clean. There's a youth center where there's an ICT center that has been set up and in fact has been oversubscribed by young people wanting to learn computer skills. But in addition to that, they have formed groups and they voluntarily go around the town collecting the dirt and keeping it clean. I would encourage you to visit there because you will be surprised at what young people are doing over there. My colleagues will both be traveling today. Andrew will be going to Uganda to visit Rhino Camp. Barney is going to Ethiopia to meet with newly displaced refugees in Gambela. I will leave for Uganda on Monday. And of course, during that period, we will also conduct visits with refugees, South Sudanese refugees in all of those countries. As always, we believe that these visits, which enable us to speak directly to both government players, the UN, and of course the people themselves, give us a better understanding of the current situation. We're one of the few commissions that the UN has set up which has had unfettered access both in South Sudan and in the neighboring countries. Last year I was up in Sudan twice in the refugee camps in Darfur, and that makes a huge difference because you are able to speak firsthand of what is happening on the ground. And for that we would like to thank the government of South Sudan and of course the governments of the neighboring countries who've made that possible.